I shall speak about constitution making. Now, I won't develop a theory on constitution making, but just challenge two recent points of consensus regarding the proper constitution making process. Now, constitution making processes are somewhat of a puzzle for constitutional theory, meaning there is very little in the name of positive or normative theory as to how a constitution should be made, which is perplexing because it would be useful to know how to make a successful constitution, whereby success, I understand, the constitution that pursues an integrative function that is effective and that endures, simply. Most constitutions last less than 19 years, according to recent studies. So this, coincidentally, is exactly the number of years that Thomas Jefferson thought a constitutional system should last.
Generation.
No. Apparently, most of them do not endure more than 19 years. Nonetheless, there is very little in the name of theory as to how a constitution should be made. Even John Elster, who is the foremost authority on constitution making, the most he could come up with is a rough set of intuitions, meaning he said that a proper constitution making process should counterbalance the triad of interest, passion, and reason, meaning these three influences on constitution making processes should be pitted against each other and counterbalanced through the process. And from this general intuition, he derived two corollaries: that a proper constitution making process should be hourglass shaped, with very broad consultations at the beginning, with an opaque constitution drafting process in the middle of the hourglass, and then a referendum at the end. And he also came up with another second corollary, meaning institutions should not be entrusted with adopting constitutions. You shouldn't charge a regular parliament with making a constitution, because there will be a fair amount of institutional self-dealing in the process. You task a parliament with adopting a constitution, you will have a parliamentary system with a weak president. So they will aggrandize their competence. Now, however, even Elster, at the end of his studies on constitution making, states that he cannot come up with a positive theory on constitution making, and that is because there are two antinomies playing in constitution making processes. On the one hand, you should have, given the importance of a constitution, a long period of reflection in order to adopt the constitution. On the other hand, most constitutions are adopted in times of turbulence, revolution, war, the breakup of a state. On the one hand, again, it should be a reasoned process, a rational, deliberative process. On the other hand, if you want the constitution to function, you should have hard-nosed bargaining among the institutions and the interest groups that are important in a given polity. So, and he said, well, I see no easy way out of this dilemma. Now, more recently, however, emerged two areas of consensus, of wide consensus, largely through the intermediary of internationalization. Namely, one, there should be wide popular or sometimes civil society consultations in the constitution-making process. The Venice Commission recommends this all the time. And the second point of convergence is there should be consultation of international institutions in the process of constitution making, in domestic constitution making processes. Let's begin with the consultation part. So there should be a wide process of consultation, open, transparent, and enough time should be given to the stakeholders to participate in the adoption of the constitution. This is counterintuitive from the very onset. Like, if you look at history, the most open constitution was the French Constitution of 1789. Debates were open in the Assemblée, and it was also a long process. It took more than 2 years, from 1789 to 1791. It only ended with the flight of the king to Varennes and the weak position of the king that had to swear an oath on the constitution, otherwise it would probably been extended even more. So, the end of September 1790. It was a very open process. This led, however, to grandstanding, to extreme positions, and the constitution as such did not endure. If you look at the American Constitution, it was a secretive process based on negotiations in Philadelphia, no openness whatsoever, either with respect to the solutions or during deliberations. There was only discussion about the document at the stage of ratification, but the actual press of constitution making was as opaque as possible. And yet it endured 200 years with only 20-some amendments, out of which some were repealed. Secondly, there is also a definitional issue at stake. This is captured quite nicely by Ivor Jennings when he says that the people cannot decide until somebody decides who are the people. Now, I know Dennis won't like that. Let's start with consultation. In Romania, we had a process of open consultation of the stakeholders in 2013. And this was a reaction to an attempt to amend the constitution in 2008 by a presidential expert commission. The expert commission was composed of 8 experts, professors of constitutional law and political scientists. So the parliament said, we will have a wide process of consultation. So for 3 months, they've asked about the constitution everyone who was considered by the parliament to be a relevant stakeholder. They held forums in some of the major cities in the country. In the end, parliament got exactly what it wanted. Why? Not because of the fact that they were trying to have a sham consultative process, but because of the fact that the sheer number of opinions that were voiced in the process made it very easy for them to pick and choose. So, paradoxically, the more open the process of consultation, the easier it is for the adopting institution to have its way at the end of the process. However, there is also an extreme position regarding participation. Sanford Levinson, for instance, he recently proposed in his book Framed that one should task the citizens themselves with adopting the constitution. And he advocated a method, the same method that is used for jury selection, meaning take people from the registry, give them for 2 years the salary of a senator or a Supreme Court justice, allow them to hold hearings throughout the United States and the world, he says, and at the end you will have a better constitution than the current one. Luckily, we also have a concrete example of such a process in the case of Iceland, mm-hmm. when in the aftermath of the crisis, a national forum was initially summoned to debate on general principles that the future constitution of Iceland should follow, mm-hmm. and they chose 8 principles, some of them very general, like transparency, the rule of law, democracy, human rights. 3 of them, however, extremely specific and very contentious. Public property over all natural resources, equal and general access to education and health care, parliamentary supervision over the financial institutions. Now, this forum was then replaced by a second forum that redebated these points, and then there was an election of members of a constitutional committee. The elections were invalidated by the Supreme Court for irregularities in the electoral process, and then those 25 members that were elected were appointed by the parliament to a constitutional council, the same people, save one who pulled out. 15 men, 10 women, I think, mostly from Reykjavik, and they deliberated for 3 months on the Constitution of Iceland. They came up with a nice document that includes rights, rights restrictions, and tries to concretize all the general principles debated in the forum. However, it failed. It failed, meaning, in spite of the fact that the referendum was held with good participation and 67% of Icelanders voting in favor of the constitution, the parliament postponed its considerations, its consideration until the end of its term, and it's unlikely at present time that it will ever be considered. So it will probably simply lapse into oblivion. Now, most commentators state, and I think it's a reasonable implication, that that is because, precisely because of the method of constitution making, meaning people deliberated on extreme solutions. They made a point out of not consulting any politician or any interest group. So they made a point out of electing to the Constitutional Council individuals who are not sitting in the Icelandic parliament. This led, of course, to a document that would be unacceptable to all the major political parties and interest groups, so it was not adopted. Let's go to the second point of consensus regarding constitution making, meaning international influence. Now, of course, there's always been international influence on domestic constitution-making processes. For example, the Platt Amendment to a military appropriations bill in the United States stated that the U.S. would intervene in Cuba if the democratic forces would relapse into dictatorship. So if there would be a threatening of the stability of democratic institutions, the United States would intervene in Cuban politics, and the Cubans took this and incorporated the Platt Amendment into their 1902 constitution. The Argentines went even further, meaning not only they copied the U.S. Constitution, but they incorporated the decisions of the United States Supreme Court in their national constitution, constitutional processes. So they made reference to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on constitutional matters with respect to Argentine constitutional decision-making. And there are the famous cases of the Japanese constitution that was imposed by MacArthur, the German constitution that was negotiated by the Parliamentary Council with the Allied commanders of the free military zones. Of course, part of the German constitution was drafted domestically, but the grand scheme of the solutions, Eternity Clause, the breakup of Prussia, protections of federalism, even minute issues such as Article 80, Section 1, the non-delegation provision, were agreed with the military commanders, and thus were incorporated in the German Constitution. There's also the international level. Resolution 181 of the General Assembly of the UN recommending the creation of two states in Palestine, one Arab, one Israeli, with parliamentary democracies, meaning presidentialism and semi-presidentialism, were rejected from the onset. But there's something different about recent internationalism, meaning it's not premised on punctual interventions, but it's premised upon the idea that there is convergence of values. I mean, you should consult international institutions that have constitution-making, constitution expertise in the domestic constitutional process. We just heard Vladimir in the morning saying that they adopted their constitution. It's a good document. It was cleared with the Venice Commission. The Venice Commission has become a major player in constitution-making processes at the fringes of Europe, and even in all the member states. And of course, as Daniel mentioned, Venice Commission recommendations are soft law. However, they become hard law by means of their incorporation into European Union Copenhagen political acquis conditionalities. So there is a cross-hybridization between these institutions. The EU refers to the Venice Commission, the Venice Commission refers to the European Union Commission. Now, so it's not purely soft law. Let's look at two examples. The first example is judicial councils. Now, the Venice Commission recommends most of the countries that adopt the constitution to guarantee judicial independence by way of a high judicial council, and this high judicial council should be composed of magistrates, which in throughout most of Europe means both prosecutors and judges, that should be elected by their peers. Now, when you look at the international documents, this seems non-problematic, yet when you look at domestic constitutional systems, you realize that there is no country that fulfills this criterion in the way in which the Venice Commission and the EU Commission by reference express it. Only Italy has a judicial council that is composed in its majority by elected magistrates, but Italy is somewhat of an oddity, and these institutional solutions did not produce very good effects upon Italian magistracy. They're thinking about changing it now. And yet, this goes on with such proposals. In Romania, we have a judicial council that was created at the behest of the Commission, and the result was complete constitutional insulation of the entire prosecutorial and judicial body from any kind of external influences, with all sorts of abnormalities resulting from the process, such as internal corruption in the judiciary, because if they're not responsible in any way to political or social forces, they will develop their own pathologies. So you won't have politicians influencing judges, you will have judicial factions influencing judges and prosecutors. And yet, in spite of this, in its report on the Icelandic constitution, the Venice Commission proposed exactly the same model. Iceland has a system of judicial and prosecutorial appointments mixed presidential-parliamentary. Yet, they said this does not correspond to European standards, and it should be changed. Iceland should create, if they were ever to adopt a constitution, they should create a high judicial council composed of magistrates that are elected by magistrates. Now, at the level of the EU and the new accession states, we could also mention budget rules, balanced budget rules. We also discussed about this in the morning. Within the EU, balanced budget rules are supposed to be constitutionalized via the fiscal compact of 2011. Article 3, paragraph 1 says that all the signatories of the treaty should should reach a structural budget deficit of no more than 0.5%, and in case the public debt of the GDP, and in case the public debt of the country is lower than 60%, that could reach, the budget deficit could go up to 1%, the structural budget deficit. And the second rule is public debt over 60% should be reduced by 1/20th each year. Now, and Article 3, paragraph 2 of the fiscal compact states that these convergence criteria should be institutionally attained by means of an independent institution. However, the prerogatives of the independent institution should not curb, should not impinge on the full prerogatives of the parliament. This is already a contradiction in terms, because the limits, if effective, should limit the parliament itself. So how can you have an independent institution that enforces these convergence criteria, yet does not impinge upon parliamentary prerogatives? Also, the rule says, Article 3, paragraph 2, also the rule says that these criteria should be at the national level included in provisions that are of binding force, permanent effect, and should be preferably constitutional or otherwise. Now, it's another antinomy. It's hard to understand how a provision can be of binding force and permanent effect and not be constitutional. Now, due to this, these irregularities, various forms have appeared throughout Europe. France, for example, passed ordinary legislation. The Dutch tasked their Council of State with the enforcement of the provisions. The Spaniards have postponed the application of the convergence criteria until 2020. Some countries make reference to older European documents that are similar to the balanced budget. So there is no unity of form, but in Hungary. In Hungary, you have a fiscal council that corresponds to the criteria in budget council that corresponds perfectly to the criteria in the fiscal compact, meaning you have free individuals with the mandate stretching from 6 years to 12 years in the case of the head of the Court of Auditors, and that should place limits on the parliament. Now, it's hard to understand how this would result in fulfilling the purpose of the treaty, whether or not they will control the parliament, or whether that will create perverse effects such as politicization of the head of the National Bank, of the head of the Court of Auditors, of the president of the Budget Council. So, with respect to, and I expect this kind of institutional settings and these kinds of contradictions to be exported to other, to newer member states, because it's already orthodoxy at the level of the European Union, to be exported to the new accession countries. However, as you see, they produce perverse effects. Why do they produce perverse effects? Precisely because of the attempt to extract general rules at the international level via international institutions, I would think. So this is not a problem of manipulation of good international rules, but a problem of raising constitutional principles to a level of a specificity that they cannot attain at the international level. If you look at the Venice Commission, for example, it was created in 1990 to further cooperation between the Western European democracies and the Central and Eastern European states. As it expanded, as its mandate was expanded, as its importance was on the rise, its membership increased exponentially. So now the Venice Commission includes 60 member states, among which Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Algeria, Israel, Chile. So when they speak of common values at this level of abstractness, it's hard to understand what common values can you have among so variegated constitutional systems. So how can you reach an institutional solution that would be common to all these constitutional systems and then impose it on another state? And yet the process continues. If you look at all new constitution-making processes, the Venice Commission is called for an opinion and they render one that afterwards is used in domestic debates.